could we talk to Ukraine about now? And what Ukraine are we talking to? The one that is a terrorist state? There's no logic and no sense in negotiating with terrorists, for they'll be constantly changing their demands and trying to turn them in their favor. There have been negotiations from the beginning of liberation operation, and as you can see, it ends in nothing.
President Zelensky has made clear that he is not interested in talks unless Russia withdraws to the territory it held before February 24th. With Russia on the front foot on the battlefield, this will not happen.
We don't say this operation is against Ukraine, for it's actually NATO who are fighting against our republics now, the collective West. It's now some kind of front line of good and evil. That's why we might be ready to negotiate. The question is, what about? Ukraine has sold its people and its sovereignty to the West against the interest of its population. So these negotiations are with who and about what?
Now, just as Russia has massive political control over the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic, so does NATO have huge political control over Ukraine. It arms them, it funds them. And so when negotiations start and what terms will be on offer in negotiations, we're very much down to NATO's decisions rather than Ukrainian government's.
The head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, recently said,
President Zelensky has stated many times this war will end at the negotiating table. The question is, what kind of position will the Ukrainians have when they negotiate a solution? Our responsibility is to make that position as strong as possible. We know that there is a very close link between what you can achieve at the negotiating table and your position on the battlefield. So our military support to them is a way to strengthen their hand.
Hundreds of soldiers, both Ukrainian and Russian, are being slaughtered every day in Donbass, so that their governments have a better hand at the negotiating table. Civilians on both sides are dying too. A mother and her 11-year-old child yesterday in Donetsk, killed by shelling of a market. Meanwhile, global leaders warn of a catastrophic global food crisis due to the conflict. Peace is still a long way off, and it looks set to be achieved on the battlefield. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
Community and wider supporters gathered to remember the victims of the Grenfell Inferno 5 years on. Many had gathered in the shadow of the building that still stands as a constant reminder of June 14th, when an inferno engulfed the tower block, leaving scores dead and thousands of others impacted and the nation traumatized. Dignitaries, including politicians and royalty, paid their respects, and for all the acts of heroism during the blaze and in its aftermath, the scars still run deep.
From my perspective, I feel like it's like a Muslim tragedy in London because of the high number of Muslims that were living here, because it was during Ramadan, because of the impact that it's had on the local community. The very first person who was named was a Somalian Muslim out of the list of people who had died in Grenfell. And I think the continuation of our story right now has to be on recognising the impact it had on the community here and what more can we do now.
The reoccurring theme when you speak with people here is the sense of frustration and anger at the way in which survivors, victims, the community, members of their family were all treated and continue to be treated. The pledges that were made, the promises that were broken, and the spectre of another Grenfell being possible.
The official Grenfell inquiry, chaired by Sir Martin Moore-Bick, that so far lasted 4 years and cost £149 million and counting, is attempting to figure out what truly happened and who was responsible. Those still fighting for answers are clear about what justice will mean in this case.
Justice will look like the fact that those people, the leaseholders, people in social housing, you know, in high-rise blocks, are living in habitable, affordable, safe homes. That is what justice will look like on one hand, and on the other hand, as I've said before, justice should look like those who are accountable for, who are responsible for this atrocity, are held accountable.
What I would like to ask this government is, what is it going to take for them to start taking this issue seriously? Is it because the people who died on Grenfell Tower on that night were mostly working class people, were mostly people of colour? Because we know for a we know that had Grenfell been in Canary Wharf, that building would not have been covered in illegal flammable cladding. It's utterly outstanding that we're 5 years on, we still have no answers. This community has received no justice, and still there are residents in this country that are living in buildings covered in the same illegal flammable cladding that was wrapped around Grenfell Tower.
Ahead of any official findings, the community of Grenfell march. They remember, and they will continue the fight for answers and justice. Amina Taylor, London.
Reading out the names of fallen British soldiers in Iraq while a man responsible for their deaths and millions more is honored. Only meters away, a protest organized by Stop the War Coalition calling for former Prime Minister Tony Blair's knighthood ceremony to stop.
It's an absolute outrage that someone who lied to the people, lied to Parliament, lied to the Cabinet, took us into an illegal war which led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people and destroyed a country should be given a knighthood. I mean, it's a disgrace.
The biggest of those lies in the so-called Iraq War dossier, a claim that former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein possessed mass murder weapons.
We knew in September 2002 that the dossier amounted to nothing. We were told it proved there were weapons of mass destruction. Everybody serious who looked at that said it didn't prove anything of the sort. Blair was determined to go to war regardless. He was determined whatever the evidence said. So essentially they cooked up the evidence.
In 2016, all the lies were exposed by the so-called Chilcot report that concluded Iraq posed no immediate threat at the time of the 2003 invasion. For Tony Blair, though, who defended his decision to go to war, that has not meant a war crimes tribunal, but the UK's most prestigious knighthood. To anti-war activists, that is a dangerous precedent.
Well, it's trying to make it easier to go to war in future. It's trying to say to politicians, even if you go to war and it's illegal, it's criminal, it's based on lies, it has nothing but devastating impact, you can still be honoured, it'll be forgive and forget.
But forgive and forget they have not. Tony Blair continues to be one of the most detested politicians at home and abroad.
Nearly two decades since the Iraq War, Tony Blair is known by tens of millions here and abroad as a war criminal, despite efforts to reinvent himself as a visionary leader, which is why these protesters say the only court Tony Blair should be attending today is not a royal one. Saipur is up, London.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Speaking to the Knesset, the European Parliament President failed to address Israeli regime's ongoing violations of Palestinian human rights. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Sami Abu Shahada, Palestinian activist. This article is published under the heading, "Once Again, Europe Reveals It Has Surrendered to Israeli Regime. Here's more." The address delivered by the President of the European Parliament, Roberto Metsola, to the Zionist regime's Knesset last month might have been one of the least responsible speeches heard from a foreign leader with regards to the Israeli regime. Coming from Malta, a country that has traditionally expressed solidarity with the Palestinian people and representing a bloc that has pushed a values-based foreign policy, rule of law and accountability, Metsola could have been expected to speak truth to power. Instead, we heard the opposite. A European surrender to the Zionist regime's policies of annexation and apartheid, as denounced by Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. Paying lip service to the two-state solution at the end of her speech did not change the fact that Metsola failed to mention the terms occupation, colonization or annexation, nor did she discuss Palestinian rights, international law, or UN resolutions. Her message was clear. Europe-Israeli relations will not be affected by the Zionist regime's systematic crimes and violations of Palestinian human rights. She adopted the Israeli Zionist narrative completely, something we would have expected from an Israeli regime official delivering a speech to the European Parliament, and not the other way around. Metsola missed no opportunity to reaffirm her position. She showed great admiration for former Zionist regime's prime minister, Golda Meir, who infamously said there was no such thing as Palestinians, and did not address the more than 65 Israeli laws that discriminate against Palestinian citizens, including the racist ban on Palestinian family reunifications approved in March. Metsola did not even mention Shirin Abu Aqile, the Al Jazeera journalist, shot by Israeli regime forces last month, and made no public call for justice. Her speech was all about reassuring the fake regime of Israel that apartheid won't harm bilateral relations. Metsola also spoke of common values and Europe's deep bond with the regime of Israel. Did she even think about how Palestinians would feel about this? What values are shared? The denial of rights, colonization, opposition to equality, demolition of homes, separation of families? If she meant justice and equality, then she knows very little about the fabricated regime of Israel. Unfortunately, Metsola is not alone in her position. Whenever the EU implements any kind of accountability in the Palestine context, it is always against the Palestinian people. Oliver Varhaley, Hungary's member of the European Commission, has criticized the content of Palestinian textbooks and pushed a freeze on European aid to Palestine. He is not a lonely anti-Palestinian voice in the EU. The question of Palestinian textbooks is a political talking point used by those who oppose the very existence of Palestine. When it comes to the fake regime of Israel, the word of right-wing think tanks and even settlers seems to have more weight in Brussels than the reports of international rights groups on Israeli regime apartheid. Even the EU Court of Justice ruling on the labeling of settlement products is not being implemented. So what credibility could Europe have when it comes to taking a position on the two-state solution? To most European countries, the savage attack by the Zionist regime forces at Abu Akleh's funeral cannot be justified, and many were surely shocked to see thousands of Israeli Jews chanting death to Arabs during the recent Al-Quds flag march. Such scenes cannot be separated from the daily realities of occupation and laws promoting a system of Jewish supremacy on both sides of the 1967 border. Europe, the Zionist regime's main trade partner, has enough tools to bring about change, including by implementing Article 2 of the EU-Israel trade agreement, which conditions its implementation on respect for human rights. Peace is a construction based on justice. If Europe continues to avoid holding the Zionist regime accountable for its systematic crimes and violations, the status quo of apartheid will remain intact. Those are not the values we were told Europe stands for.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Spotlight. Palestinians have held a funeral ceremony for three men shot dead by Israeli forces during a raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the northern part of the West Bank. Nearly 80 Palestinians were also wounded in the ensuing clashes. Resistance movement Hamas says Israel will pay for its crimes, and the Israeli measures will only strengthen Palestinians' resolve to continue their resistance. Israel has in recent months intensified its attacks in the occupied territories. Jenin is the hardest hit following a series of anti-Israel operations by Palestinians there. The Palestinian Health Ministry says more than 60 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces this year, many of them in raids, incursions, and arbitrary killings by the Israeli army. On tonight's Spotlight, we have Johannesburg. And also we have international coordinator of the Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, Charlotte Cates, joining us from Vancouver.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the program, to the both of you. Let's start off with Mr. Ahmad Mayet in Johannesburg. Israel has in recent months intensified its attacks in the occupied territories. How do you view the recent wave of Israeli atrocities against Palestinians?
The situation in Palestine must be understood through two lenses, the first being the regional lens and the second being the domestic lens. The regional lens is very clear. Israel is still trying very hard to reestablish something called the deterrence equation. Israel was developed on the principle of deterrence, meaning the fear of the Arabs around them, and they thrive on this using excessive force. It was seen in Lebanon, in Dahiya, and they are trying very hard to reestablish that regional deterrence equation with the current activity with the gas platform off the coast of Lebanon. However, on the domestic front, Israel has somewhat reset the deterrence equation that was established by Saif al-Quds, the military operation, the 11-day operation that was waged against Israel in defense of Jerusalem. What we are seeing now, the massacres that are taking place within the occupied West Bank, the portion of Palestine occupied by Israel, with security cooperation by the Palestinian Authority, is a means of appeasing the Israeli population that they are doing something. And this is not my words. This is from Oded Parlov, who works for the INSS, who works for the Israeli Foreign Affairs Department, and he is an advisor to the sellout states, the Arab states that have normalized ties with Israel. They are saying that this has no true effect on what they call their security concerns. It's merely a means of appeasing the Israeli population. Basically, Palestinian lives are being sacrificed to put smiles on occupier colonial settler faces. That's the summary of the situation.
Charlotte Cates, Jenin has been the hardest hit following a series of anti-Israel operations by Palestinians there. Also, there were some reprisal attacks, if you recall, against Israelis in the heart of Tel Aviv. Give us your perspective on the significance of these operations as Palestinians are venting their anger at the regime's crimes and occupation.
Well, it's very clear that despite 74 years, and indeed over 74 years, of Zionist colonialism inside occupied Palestine, what the occupation has failed to do through all of that time is to quash Palestinian resistance. And so we see that today. Certainly we see that in Gaza, where the resistance is perhaps stronger than it has ever been throughout the history of the Palestinian Revolutionary Movement. And it's also something that we see in Jenin. And Jenin, in many ways, has become a very dangerous symbol to the Israeli occupation, because the purpose of creating the so-called Palestinian Authority was to create a security coordination process and a tool, an agent of the colonizer to repress the resistance on behalf of the colonial force. And what we can see 30 years after Oslo is that this has entirely failed in quashing the will of the people to resist, and that despite all forms of assassination, torture, mass imprisonment, targeting, extrajudicial killings, that over and over again, the Palestinian people and their resistance organizations continue to rebuild, continue to mobilize. And so the mere existence of the Jenin brigades, of this ongoing strength and power of the armed resistance in Jenin, which comes hand in hand with all of the various forms of popular resistance practiced by the Palestinian people, it shows that Zionism has never been able to crush Palestinian resistance and will never be able to crush Palestinian resistance. And so these attempts to sort of wipe out the resistance by taking Palestinian lives, by imposing trauma and devastation on families and loved ones and mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters and wives and husbands and children of the martyrs, this is an exercise of brutality. This is an exercise of colonial violence and colonial brutality. But what it has never done and never will do is silence the message and the vision of these martyrs and all of those who continue to fight, which is for the liberation of Palestine from the river to the sea.
Ahmad Mayet, resistance movement Hamas says Israel will pay for its crimes and the Israeli measures will only strengthen Palestinians' resolve to continue their resistance against the regime. Will these Israeli crimes make Palestinians more united in the face of the occupation?
Yes, I agree with the sentiments that have been expressed by Hamas. The attacks against the populations of Jenin, if you look in 2022, of the 70 Palestinians that have been martyred thus far, approximately we're looking at round about 27, I would say, are from Jenin alone. Jenin was always the heart of resistance during the Al-Aqsa Intifada. It was Ariel Sharon, Arik Schreinemann, who called Jenin the cockroach's nest and was renamed by the Palestinians as the nest of angels. It has been the core of resistance. It's in April, it was 20 years since the Jenin massacre. And now Israel is sitting with a very difficult problem. How do they show to their population that they're doing something without sparking a massive regional war? They can't go to Gaza. It is very clear from Saif al-Quds that the escalation, according to them, was not visible through any forms of intelligence or any forms of prediction. And therefore, they're quite afraid of escalating in Gaza, the usual stomping ground of the IDF. So they're trying to do it with periodic attacks into Jenin. And like my colleague has said, is that Jenin is now a symbol of resistance for the Palestinian people, because Israel has also taken some casualties during their raids into Jenin. What we have, and the key to this problem, is the cooperation, the security cooperation between the Palestinian Authority and the Israeli regime. It's not very different from what was happening here in apartheid South Africa and the Bantustans, and that is why you had people like Chris Hani, was the leader of the SACP and the chief of staff of Mkhonto we Sizwe, the armed movement of the ANC, together with Ronnie Kasrils in September of 1992, fighting against these puppets of the apartheid regime, saying that they have to remove the parasites. The key to this resistance in the West Bank is to remove the security cooperation with the Israeli state and remove the puppets from their seats. They are working as agents of Israel, and it has not worked in South Africa. They were removed, and this is what needs to happen on the ground in Palestine.
Charlie Cates, the Palestinian Foreign Ministry has also reacted to the recent events. It called on the International Criminal Court to investigate crimes committed by Israeli forces and settlers. Will that ever happen, in your opinion, given the staunch support that the Israelis have from the United States? How can the status quo ever change, in your opinion?
When these crimes are carried out by Israeli occupation forces, it's important to note that these are not Israeli crimes alone. These are not just the crimes of the Zionist regime. These are crimes that are fully funded and backed and supported by the U.S. government, the Canadian government, the governments of the European Union, the governments that not only continue to provide weaponry and advanced technology to the Israeli occupation, but continue to engage in security coordination with it, continue to list Palestinian organizations and Palestinian resistance movements as terrorist organizations, despite the fact that what they are doing is a legitimate exercise of resistance in defense of a colonized people seeking liberation. These governments are part and parcel of the criminal project. They are responsible for these war crimes. So in many ways, if we are expecting, the current governments in the U.S. and Canada and Europe to take the lead in prosecuting Israeli occupation, that's something that we may have a long time to wait for. But what we do see is that within these countries, the people of these countries actually don't agree with what their governments are doing. We see when we look at last year in May 2021 during Saif al-Quds and the Unity Intifada, what did we see in the cities of the world? Tens of thousands of people pouring into the streets in the heart of the empire to say, we stand with Palestine, no more Israeli apartheid, no more Israeli crimes, no to Zionism, no to racism. And so the fact is that it is very essential, especially for those of us who are in these countries and working to organize for Palestine, to do everything that we can to put meaningful and powerful pressure on these states to cut off the flow of military, diplomatic, economic, and political support and impunity that is being given to the Israeli occupation regime. And so in terms of the International Criminal Court, there are many very distinguished and committed Palestinian and international lawyers that are working to pursue this there. But what we see instead from much of the leadership of the International Criminal Court is an interest in pursuing only African leaders and those who are on the other side from imperialist powers, rather than actually pursuing the major perpetrators of injustice in the world, who are these very imperialist powers who are standing in line with the Israeli occupation state. And so, unfortunately, for far too long, the Palestinian foreign ministry, rather than representing the interests of the Palestinian people, has, you know, continued to engage in a strategy that seeks to essentially give in to the US and Europe, despite the fact that those powers are funding, promoting, and supporting Zionist colonization in Palestine. The first step that any Palestinian Authority entity can take is to bring an end immediately to the security coordination process, which is putting the Palestinian sure. resistance and the Palestinian people on a in danger on a daily basis.
Ahmed Mayet, an analyst that we spoke to here on Press TV earlier, also believes that the Palestinians have every right to fight the Israeli occupation and they should be supported in their struggle. You agree with that notion, of course. Are Palestinians receiving the support that they need? And if not, how can that support be enhanced?
The right to resist an occupation is an international law right. That right, if we want to look at any other precedent, South Africa was the perfect precedent. We had the armed struggle here under Mkhonto we Sizwe and many other movements. In fact, when Chris Hani was assassinated, the chief of staff of Mkhonto we Sizwe, it was the speech of the first democratically elected president of South Africa, the late Nelson Mandela, who said that it's not a question of armed resistance or negotiations. At the time, they were negotiating with the apartheid regime for the end of this horrendous form of governance. He said it's not a decision between armed resistance and negotiations. It is armed resistance that brought the Afrikaner apartheid government to the negotiating table. Therefore, it's indicative of the fact that you cannot exclude the armed resistance from the equation, which many are trying to do through different means. And this is the very serious threat that is now presenting itself. Armed resistance is a cornerstone of the Palestinian movement. It is the key to the liberation of Palestine. We've had negotiations for many years, and what has that produced? It's produced eaten up Palestinian land, more settlements, further oppression, and periodic attacks against the Palestinians. What we have now is an axis of resistance stretching all the way from the borders of Pakistan, going through into Afghanistan. You have the Islamic Republic of Iran that has bolstered the Palestinians' ability to defend themselves and to actually stand up and assert their rights. And that is what we saw with Saif al-Quds. We saw the reclamation of dignity, and this axis has gone far beyond. It's gone to Iraq. It is on the borders of Syria, looking into Golan. We have it in Lebanon with Hezbollah, and we have it in the south with Gaza and even far as Ansarullah in Yemen. The armed resistance is going to be the key to the liberation of the Palestinian people, as together with movements such as boycott, divestment, and sanction, and more so not the movement, but rather the tool of boycott, divestment, and sanction, and global support. However, we cannot shy away from the right of oppressed people to defend themselves. This is not an offensive war, it's a defensive war. And I think that reality is very clear. It was proven in South Africa, and it is now proven in Palestine.
Charlotte Cates, more land confiscations and evictions are taking place by the Israelis. It was just announced yesterday, if I'm correct, that the regime is planning to confiscate a vast swath of Palestinian land in the occupied West Bank, around 1,000 square kilometers of Palestinian territory from Al-Quds all the way to the Dead Sea, in what's being viewed as its largest expansionist program. Under international law, we know the Israeli judicial system has no legal authority over the population it occupies. Human Rights Watch, for example, has said on numerous occasions that Israel's policies amount to apartheid and crimes against humanity. And why are these policies still continuing then?
These policies are continuing because they are being funded and backed by very powerful imperialist states. The Israeli occupation regime, the Zionist project in Palestine, would cease to exist if U.S. imperialism cut off the endless flow of money and protective support that it provides to this project. And in fact, this is something that the Zionist Project is very concerned about. When we see all of these propaganda campaigns, campaigns of criminalization, campaigns of targeting Palestine organizing in the United States and internationally, one of the reasons for this is that it's very clear that young people, that progressive people, that people in general who want to see a more just world and a just society do recognize that Zionism is racism, and that Israeli settler colonialism, that Zionist colonization of Palestine is something that simply cannot be part of a just world and a just society. And so for those of us that are working for justice outside occupied Palestine, one of the most important things that we can do is everything that we can to put pressure on these governments that are continuing to fund, support, and arm the occupation regime, to hold them accountable for their crimes against the Palestinian people, and to organize to defend the Palestinian people and their resistance for the liberation of Palestine from the river to the sea. Because the Palestinian resistance is on the front lines fighting back, not just for the liberation of Palestine, but really for a just and democratic future for humanity, sure, which is something that cannot coexist with apartheid, settler colonialism, occupation and oppression.
Ahmed Maid, you heard the plans, the most recent plans of the Israeli regime of more land confiscations. What are the Israelis achieving with this land grab policy? Apart from Judaization of Palestinian land, are the Israelis also deliberately sabotaging any prospects of an independent Palestinian state in the future?
The framework has changed drastically from a two-state discussion to a one-state reality. The Israeli confiscations of large tracts of land right now is an attempt to establish facts on the ground so that when they are forced to the table to discuss the dismantlement of the state, they have more to deal with than being put into a position where they are forced to accept the precepts of international law. What is happening now within the human rights discourse is that the very foundations of Israel is being questioned. You have it from Human Rights Watch, you have it from Amnesty International, and you have it from B'Tselem, to name a few. The establishment of the state of Israel was based on the principles of terror, it was based on ethnic superiority, and it is a state that favors only one group of people. It is hardly democratic, its very foundations are flawed, and therefore it has to be dismantled. Israel knows this, and this is why Israel is acting in the manner it is acting. It is very similar to the manner in which the apartheid regime behaved towards the end of its life. Israel is now facing a situation where the military equation has changed, because any attempt to jihadize the precincts of Masjid al-Aqsa and Jerusalem, al-Quds, will now create a regional war. And that regional war will overwhelm Israel. In fact, this is the latest statements from the Israeli military leaders. They are aware of that. And therefore, they are trying to gain whatever advantage they can by stealing tracts of land, by building settlements, etc., in a gray zone principle, meaning that they are trying to push the parameters as far as they can without sparking a war. This is gray zone tactics from Israel, but the time is, the clock is rather ticking, and Israel is running out of time. It's very, very clear. This is not our comments. This is not from a pro-Palestinian or Palestinian supporter comment. It is a situation that is coming out from Israeli military reports. They are saying that this is not a sustainable project, and apartheid was not sustainable, colonialism was not sustainable, and the Israeli Zionist project is not sustainable. It is basically the end of Israel, and these are the last kicks of a dying horse.
All right, that brings us to an end here on this edition of our program. Allow me to thank my guests, attorney, activist, and political analyst Zakir Ahmed Maya, joining us from Johannesburg, and thanks to international coordinator Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network Charlotte Cates, joining us from Vancouver, and also special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight.
Bye, everybody. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
By late May, the situation had become so critical that some American states, including New York, declared a state of emergency due to the shortage of infant formula, which compelled the U.S. president to order the import of the basic commodity with military aircraft from countries such as Germany. We now present you an article written by Mohammad Mahdi Abbasi, an Iranian researcher focusing on American affairs. The piece is titled, From Operation Fly Formula to Biden's Popularity Plunge. Welcome to US 2022. Operation Fly Formula may sound odd to you, but it is actually the name picked by US President Joe Biden and the White House for an operation launched to speed up the importation of infant formula to the country. Under the operation, the US Department of Defense, the Pentagon, is partnering with other departments to pick up overseas infant formula to help ease the dire shortage inside the country. More than 100,000 pounds of this basic commodity has been imported to the United States in several stages. But what is behind the formula shortage that has forced the so-called world's largest economy to resort to imports? It was 14th of May when photographs and reports about a severe shortage of infant formula in the United States went viral for the first time. The figures during the first days of the crisis showed that in 25 states, 40 to 50% of baby formula products went out of stock, and in many regions across the states, more than half of the stores were out of the product. By late May, the situation had become so critical that some states, including New York, declared a state of emergency due to the shortage, which compelled the US President Joe Biden to order the import of the basic commodity with military aircraft from countries such as Germany. Following the nationwide shortage, the Biden administration faced a barrage of criticisms as the dire situation cast doubt on the administration's competence more than ever. House Republican Conference Chair Elise Stefanik delivered remarks on the horrific nationwide baby formula shortage, saying that President Biden has continued to pass the buck. Children, babies, have been put to bed hungry, while parents are desperately trying to find alternative formulas that are often difficult to procure. This is not a third world country. This should never have happened in the United States of America. Damian Lee, an American professional basketball player, also said, "It's sad. The world that we live in, it's easier to get a gun than baby formula right now," referring to the shooting in Uvalde, Texas, which left 19 children and two school teachers dead. "That's unbelievable in this country that we live in." The criticism continued even after the shipments of infant formula arrived in the United States. When 78,000 pounds of infant formula arrived in the U.S. from Germany, Republican Derek Van Orden, a candidate running for Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District, said, when the richest country in the world has to use military aircraft to import baby formula, something is wrong with the government. Biden has broken America. Former US President Donald Trump also did not miss the opportunity to blame the current administration and, in a statement, criticized the formula shortage. Issued through his Save America Political Action Committee, Donald Trump said in his statement, "The Democrats are sending another $40 billion to Ukraine, yet America's parents are struggling to even feed their children." The former president further said, "No one is talking about the baby formula shortage in the United States, which he said is a national disgrace. It is unthinkable that in the year 2022, American families are unable to get baby formulas for their children." You may wonder how the United States has reached such a critical situation in supplying infant formula. To answer this question, various factors contributing to this issue need be mentioned, including the global food supply chain crisis, which is primarily attributed to the coronavirus pandemic and the closure of important baby formula factories in the United States. Interestingly, four major companies control 90% of the infant formula industry in the United States today, with Abbott factory being the biggest producer. The large company shut down its Michigan factory due to possible bacterial contamination, resulting in the infection of four infants who consumed its products, further deepening the baby formula shortage crisis across the United States. Nearly a month after the nationwide crisis in the United States, store shelves in many American stores are still bare of baby formula. Recently, Blair Hayes, an author and a mother, wrote in The Guardian that she traveled to four different cities to find a canister of formula for my baby. In the meantime, the US President Joe Biden said in an interview recently that he was not personally aware of the severity of the infant formula shortage until early April. That interview, along with other contradictory remarks by Biden administration officials, further fueled public anger directed at US federal government and dealt a final blow to the lifeless body of Biden's popularity. According to numerous reliable polls, Joe Biden's approval rating has dropped to below 40%, and the continuation of such a critical situation, of which inflation and formula shortage are merely a portion, can come at the cost of a crushing defeat for the Democratic Party in the 2022 elections, or even Joe Biden's resignation. A new opinion poll has found that most Americans say the economy and inflation are the primary factors in determining how they will vote for Congress in the midterm elections this November. U.S. inflation rose to its highest level in the past 40 years in March and currently is hovering around 8%. American consumers have been significantly affected by the rising cost of basic goods and services, including gas and food. In the latest ABC News Ipsos opinion poll, more than 80% of the American public said the economy and inflation were an extremely or very important factor shaping up their vote this fall. President Joe Biden has received low approval ratings for his handling of these key issues, suggesting trouble for the president and the Democratic candidates ahead of the midterm elections. The opinion poll found that slightly more than a third of the American public, 37%, approve of how Biden is handling the economy, and even fewer approve of his handling of inflation and gas prices. 28% and 27% respectively. The latest jobs report says that the U.S. economy added 390,000 jobs in the month of May, while the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported on Friday, 10th of June, the unemployment rate remained unchanged at 3.6%. President Biden praised the jobs report as excellent, but acknowledged that many Americans were worried about the status of the U.S. economy. President Biden said, "I know that even with today's good news, a lot of Americans remain anxious, and I understand that they're feeling." President Biden has claimed combating inflation is his top domestic priority, adding that the White House has been searching frantically for remedies. The U.S. president claimed that he has taken several steps towards that goal, including by agreeing to tap into the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to generate relief at the pump. President Biden is also considering lifting some tariffs on Chinese products to ease inflation. The ABC News Ipsos opinion poll also found that gun violence and inflation are another two important factors in the upcoming election. 72% of respondents said gun violence was extremely or very important, and 63% said the same thing about inflation. 70% of those surveyed said they think reforming gun laws should be a higher priority than protecting the right to own guns. Only 29% said protecting the right to own a firearm was more important. On Thursday, President Biden addressed the nation in the wake of a series of mass shootings across the United States and said if members of Congress fail to act, the American people will vote them out. He said, "If Congress fails, I believe this time a majority of the American people won't give up. I believe the majority of you will act to turn your outrage into making this issue central to your vote. Enough is enough."